Okay, I started on purpose from the second slide because I didn't want to give you a surprise for a title. So what we're doing is peak simulations of acceleration in relativistic shocks. And if you find an acronym for it, it will be PICSARS. If you put an X here instead of CS, it will be something famous, especially in the US. And so that's why we have nice movies as well. So the question that we would like to address is how the particle acceleration efficiency in relativistic shocks depend on a series of parameters. And the parameters that we'll be studying here is the strength, inclination of the magnetic field, and the composition of the upstream flow. And then we'll try to convert this information that we get for the particle acceleration and the magnetic field generation into something which is actually observable, like the emission signatures. The method that we employed is the particle in cell simulations, and a few words about the simulation setup that we usually use. We have an incoming flow propagating towards the left, a reflecting wall against which, off which the incoming flow is bouncing, and the counter-streaming between the incoming flow and the reflective flow triggers the formation of a shock which propagates to the right in this picture. The simulation is performed in the downstream frame in which the downstream flow is at rest. And for some cases, we also add a magnetic field. So in general, the upstream flow is electron-positron or electron-proton plasma with a reduced mass ratio of between 16 and 100, typically. Cold plasma with a bulk Lorentz factor of 15 and a magnetization defined as the ratio of the magnetic energy to the kinetic energy of the upstream flow between zero unmagnetized shocks, or 0.1 or even more than this. And we also vary the angle between the magnetic field of the upstream and the shock normal, which we call theta. Theta will be measured in the downstream frame. Mostly 2D simulations in terms of like spatial dimensions, three-dimensional for the velocities and the electromagnetic fields, but most of the results have been confirmed with actual 3D simulations. I will discuss, first of all, two like very different cases in terms of shock structure and particle acceleration, and these two cases will be the unmagnetized case and the magnetized sigma equal 0.1 perpendicular case. The unmagnetized case is showing the viable filamentation in the upstream, so this is the upstream, downstream, and the shock, and both in the density and in the magnetic energy generation at the shock. The other case, the opposite case, perpendicular shock, sigma equal 0.1, magnetization of 0.1, and inclination angle of 90 degrees, is mediated by magnetic reflection. The shock transition is much sharper, much more narrow, and the magnetic field is obviously compressed at the shock by MHD, as the MHD jump conditions predict. What I'm showing here is a slightly different setup. In the previous case, we had a shock which was propagating away from a wall, and the wall was sort of representing the contact discontinuity. Here, the contact discontinuity is in between. We are colliding two shells, and we have a forward shock propagating to the right and a reverse shock propagating to the left, or the other way around. Choose whatever you prefer. In the vertical plane, we have magnetic energy. In the horizontal plane, density. And this is an unmagnetized shock. And you see the viable, the typical viable filamentation here, which is associated with typically an unmagnetized shocks, both in the magnetic energy and in the density. The situation is dramatically different for a magnetized shocks, in which the density jump is much sharper, and the magnetic energy jump is also much, much sharper. In terms of the acceleration efficiency, these two cases are also greatly different. For a magnetized sigma 0.1 perpendicular shock, the downstream spectrum is essentially thermal. Instead, for an unmagnetized shock, we observe downstream spectrum, which is the sum essentially of a thermal distribution, a thermal bump, plus a superthermal tail. In the tail, which has a power law slope of minus 2.4 plus or minus 0.1, there are 1% of particles and roughly 10% of the energy of the upstream flow. This is true both for electron-positron shocks and electron-ion shocks, as Martins et al. Have shown, with a reduced mass ratio of 32. And electrons and ions are more or less equally accelerated. In terms of the acceleration mechanism which is operating in these unmagnetized shocks, what I will be showing you now is a plot of the particle trajectory which is this narrow line superimposed over the magnetic energy. And at the same time, we'll be tracking the particle energy. So a particle trajectory here and particle energy is here. And the dot at the center of the particle trajectory will be proportional. The size of the dot will be proportional to the particle energy itself. So the particle is coming towards the shock and then bouncing back and forth between the shock and the upstream with small deflections against this upstream filaments, upstream viable filaments. The particle sometimes comes back to the shock. Eventually, it may go downstream, and downstream, its energy is not changing anymore because we are doing a simulation in the downstream frame. So there are no electric fields in the downstream, and then the particle may come back again to the shock and surf towards the upstream, being kicked by these filaments which are advected towards the shock, and finally the particle is advected downstream. So far, two simple cases, unmagnetized versus magnetized perpendicular shocks. One more degree of freedom is given by the obliquity of the magnetic field with respect to the shock normal. And if you fix the magnetization, then there is a critical obliquity angle for that magnetization, which is separating the cases in which a particle sliding along the magnetic field lines can return upstream versus the cases in which the particle cannot return upstream along the magnetic field lines. The first one, the first case is called subluminal shock, and the second one is a superluminal shock. And the obliquity angle, which is separating these two regimes for relativistic shocks reasonably magnetized larger than 10 to the minus 2, is around 34 degrees. This is measured in the downstream fluid frame. If you convert it to the upstream fluid frame, you should divide by the gamma factor of the upstream flow. So it's a very tiny angle in the end. The purpose of our discussion then is to see and to study how the field obliquity may have an effect for the shock structure and the particle acceleration. A case of a subluminal shock with a magnetization of 0.1 and an inclination angle of the magnetic field with respect to the shock normal of 15 degrees. This is subluminal. The critical angle is 34 degrees. This is 15. And what we see is that there is a population of particles, this hot diffuse beam of particles, which have been accelerated at the shock, and they are returning upstream. This is their x momentums, and it's positive, meaning that those particles are actually coming back upstream. And the same is true both for electron-positron shocks, in which both positrons and electrons are coming back upstream. And it's true for electron-proton shocks, with the only difference that in this case, there are mostly protons coming back upstream. There are very few electrons. And we'll be coming back to this point for the acceleration efficiency. As a consequence of the fact that there are particles coming back from the shock into the upstream medium, there are waves triggered by the counter-streaming of those particles with the incoming beam. And the topology and the features of the wave may differ between the electron-positron case and the electron-proton case. In one case, they are oblique. The wave vector is oblique with respect to the upstream flow. In the other case, it's longitudinal. And these waves may be like the bell waves that we have been talking about a lot. But for the relativistic case, this is a relativistic shock. But the bottom line is that there are particles coming back upstream. These particles excite the growth of waves in the upstream medium. And these waves are important for the acceleration of the particles themselves. So there is a loop between particles and waves in the between the accelerated particles at the shock and the waves produced in the upstream medium for a subluminal shock. For a superluminal shock, like 45 degrees, everything is much more boring. You don't have particles coming back upstream from the shock, accelerated particles coming back upstream, both for the electron-positron case and the electron-ion case. And as a consequence, there are no waves triggered upstream. So no returning particles and no upstream waves in case of superluminal shocks. In terms of the acceleration efficiency, we have done a survey of angles for shocks with a magnetization of 0.1. And the downstream spectra for superluminal shock, for superluminal shocks like 45 degrees here, it's essentially a thermal distribution. So superluminal shocks don't accelerate that much. This is consistent with what I've said before in terms of sigma 0.1 perpendicular shocks. 45 and above are not accelerating particles. Shocks with obliquities 45 and above are not accelerating particles. The interesting thing is that as you increase the obliquity from zero, which corresponds to a parallel shock, to 30 degrees, which is close to this boundary, 34 degrees between subluminal and superluminal configurations, the acceleration efficiency is actually increasing. And the reason for this is that there is a new acceleration mechanism which is taking over for these oblique shocks. For parallel shocks, the main acceleration mechanism is the diffusive shock acceleration or Fermi-like acceleration, the same as for the unmagnetized shocks. The particle essentially bounces between the shock and the upstream waves, which have been triggered by the returning particles themselves. And in doing so, its energy increases until the particle is eventually advected downstream and it doesn't change its energy anymore. For angles which are close to the boundary between subluminal and superluminal configurations, instead, the particle is essentially trapped at the shock and gyrating, just Larmor gyration around the shock. And it's being accelerated in doing this. The mechanism responsible for the acceleration is the shock drift acceleration due to the background electric field. This shock is oblique, and there is a background electric field in the upstream medium because the simulation is done in the downstream frame, so there is no electric field in the downstream medium. But there is an electric field in the downstream, in the upstream medium, which is responsible for the particle acceleration. And it's easy to see from the behavior of the gamma factor with respect to time then that every time the particle is in the upstream, is accelerated. And every time the particle is in the downstream, it's not accelerating. And the signature for this, this is the typical signature for the shock drift acceleration. So we have discussed what's happening for magnetized shocks in case of pair shocks. And now let's change the composition of the upstream flow to electron-proton shocks. Protons essentially are accelerated in the same way as pairs in electron-positron shocks. So this is the diagram that I've plotted, I've shown before for pairs. And this is the equivalent plot for ions in electron-ion shocks. And you see that in the same way, superluminal shocks are not accelerating. And subluminal shocks are accelerating the more efficiently, the closer they are to this subluminal-superluminal boundary. The situation is different for electrons. And in general, what's happening is that electrons are accelerated a factor of 5 or 10 less efficiently than ions. This is the sort of a high energy tail for electrons, which is not actually a tail. It's just a slight deviation with respect to a thermal distribution. And the reason why electrons are not efficiently accelerated, it's easy to understand if you look at the particle trajectories. If you look at typical ions, accelerated ions coming into the shock, you see the ions penetrating into the downstream a little bit, and then the ions is able to come back upstream, experience the effect of these waves, and be accelerated by the presence of these upstream waves until it's eventually like advected in the downstream region. Instead, if you're focusing on an electron, the electron Larmor radius entering into the shock is much smaller than the ion Larmor radius that I've shown before. So the electrons is easily advected into the downstream medium without being significantly accelerated. So essentially, the reason for the difference acceleration efficiency between ions and electrons is that the ions enter the shock with a Larmor radius large enough such that they can come back upstream. Instead, the electrons are strongly tied to the magnetic field, and they are advected downstream without much chance of returning upstream and being further accelerated. And if this is true, then an additional consequence of this would be that the acceleration efficiency for the electrons should be a strong function of the magnetization. And indeed, that's what's happening. Here we have fixed the magnetic obliquity angle, 15 degrees in this case and 30 degrees in this other case. And we have changed the magnetization of the upstream flow from unmagnetized shock to a 0.1, sigma of 0.1 magnetized shocks. And what you see is that the acceleration efficiency for electrons is decreasing dramatically with magnetization. And the reason is the same as I've said before. The more you increase the magnetization of the flow, the more the electrons are tied to the magnetic field lines. As a consequence, they are more easily advected into the downstream medium, which corresponds to a lower efficiency of the electron acceleration, is independent of theta. Let me remind you that these angles, 15 and 30, are nominally subluminal. So these are the angles in which the acceleration is likely to be more efficient. And it's actually more efficient for ions. But there are further problems in accelerating electrons because essentially electrons are tied to the magnetic field lines. Finally, to switch a little bit topics, so far we have discussed particle acceleration and a little bit magnetic field amplification, and now I would like to connect this to what's observed, because every theory is good until you confront it with observations. So what we have done is to trace the simulation particles. So these are particles whose trajectory is taken from the simulation, and the particles are filling the fields of the simulation itself. So the particle trajectories are entirely self-consistent. And doing using this, we have been able to compute the spectra of the of a non-magnetized shock, an unmagnetized shock, using the full information of the particles. And what we have found is that the low-frequency spectral index is entirely consistent with the prediction of the synchrotron theory. In particular, here we're getting a slope of 2/3, which is not the 1/3 slope, but just because our simulation is 2D. So in 2D, you would expect 2/3, and we have I'm doing the same experiment in 3D, and I'm getting the 1/3 as for the synchrotron. There is an important contribution to the spectrum given by the suprathermal particles. This is the thermal contribution, which is determining the low energy, the low frequency slope, but it's not dominating the high frequencies. And importantly also, we find that at least for unmagnetized shock, there is a non-negligible contribution to the spectrum by the upstream particles. So here I'm disentangling the contribution of the downstream particles, the solid line here, and the dotted line instead is the contribution of the upstream particles. And you see that at the for the suprathermal energies, the upstream contribution is equal or even more important than the contribution of the downstream particles. So this is potentially something that could be important for modeling the spectral energy distributions or the spectra from astrophysical objects, because usually we use the distribution function and the information that we have from the downstream medium, and here we are saying that the upstream contribution is also non-negligible. I'm summarizing. It's a long summary, so I'll try not to give too much detail. Relativistic unmagnetized shocks are mediated by the Weibull instability. Magnetized perpendicular shocks instead are mediated by magnetic reflection. If the shock is unmagnetized, we have roughly 1% of particle and 10% of energy in the suprathermal tail, both for electron positron and for electron ion shocks. The situation is different if we increase the magnetization above, let's say, 10 to the minus 2. In this case, electron-positron shocks are efficient accelerators. Again, 1% by numbers, 10% by energy, roughly, but only for subluminal obliquities. So this magnetic field inclination angle, obliquity angle, should be less than 34 in the downstream, as measured in the downstream fringe, which corresponds to 34 divided by the upstream Lorentz factor in the upstream fluid frame. For electron-proton shocks, the ion acceleration proceeds the same, essentially, as for electrons and positrons in pair shocks, a little bit more efficient, 3% by number, 20% by energy. And the electron acceleration, instead, is suppressed by a factor of 5 to 10 with respect to the ion acceleration, even for subluminal obliquities, especially for high magnetization. So this is potentially a challenge to get efficient electron acceleration in high sigma electron-proton shocks. To reinforce the same conclusions with colors, on the left I'm showing the number, the fraction of particles in the suprathermal tail for electron-positron shocks or for ions in electron-proton shocks. The two behave roughly similarly. And we see that for unmagnetized shocks, which is, so this is sigma is a function of the obliquity angle. For unmagnetized shocks, sigma less than 10 to the minus 3, roughly 1% in number fraction contributed by the suprathermal tail. And as we increase the magnetization, what's happening is that there is a new the new acceleration mechanism, like the shock drift acceleration, which is giving a larger acceleration efficiency of the order of 3%. And then, as you increase instead the obliquity angle to go to superluminal angles, the acceleration efficiency abruptly drops. So you have no more accelerated particles in this region of high obliquities and high magnetizations. The situation is even worse if you look at electrons in electron-proton shocks. In this case, for unmagnetized shocks, you have still this 1% that I'm quoting. But if you increase the magnetization essentially for any fixed angle, then your acceleration efficiency is dropping because of this effect that electrons are more tied to magnetic field lines and they are more easily advected downstream. So little chance for acceleration. Acceleration is like, in terms of number fraction, 0.2, 0.1, so much smaller than in the other case. Still, the boundaries given by the superluminal angles is still there. For superluminal angles, there is no acceleration. In terms of acceleration mechanisms, for unmagnetized shocks, you have the diffusive shock acceleration. The same is true for magnetized but parallel shocks or quasi-parallel. But as you go to higher obliquities, you also have this shock drift mechanism powered by the upstream motional electric field. What's the implication for this? Essentially, we can now constrain the composition of and the magnetization of the flow. In particular, if you have an electron positron plasma, then nearly parallel shocks are required with the obliquity in the upstream fluid frame less than 34 divided by the upstream Lorentz factor. Or to have a significant particle acceleration, the magnetization must be very low, less than 10 to the minus 3. Instead, if you have an electron ion plasma, the magnetization must be low, meaning less than 10 to the minus 2, essentially independent of the obliquity. Since we have seen that for highly magnetized shocks, electron acceleration is not very efficient even for subluminal configurations. Caveats that I should mention to these conclusions, a long-term shock evolution may be different with respect to what we have seen so far. Although in some cases, I think we're reasonably confident to have captured most of the evolution. 3D simulations may be different, although we tried all of the 3D simulations that we tried have confirmed 2D results. We tried mass ratio of 100. Maybe if you go higher in mass ratio, something else is happening. Or there are some physics which is missing from the simulations. In particular, a different magnetic field geometry may change the picture. If you have magnetic dissipation or magnetic turbulence, then in this case, there may be other acceleration mechanisms like acceleration via reconnection. Or if if the composition of the upstream flow is different, like you have an ion-doped pair of plasma, then still acceleration may proceed in other ways, like with it's called resonant cyclotron absorptions. Thanks.
I don't understand why the electrons are not accelerated in electron-proton plasma. If they are thermalized downstream, they got an energy comparable to gamma times proton mass. And if they come back upstream, they have an energy of order gamma square proton mass, which is similar to what reflected proton has. So why should they be more tied to the magnetic field than less accelerated?
So my understanding is as follows. Like on one side, there is one more thing which I've not mentioned, which is the cross-shock potential, electric potential, which is reflecting ions more efficiently than electrons, so the ions have a larger chance to come back upstream for this reason. The one more thing that I'm seeing, and it's also like visible from the movies that I've shown, is that the electron, it's true that the electron thermalize with respect to the ions, but they don't thermalize to 100%. So it may be that the electron energy is still a factor of like 3 to 5 lower than the ion energy. And above, also like this thermalization is this value that I'm quoting for a thermalization is a value which is good for the downstream. And you need particles to come back to the upstream from the shock, essentially, in order to have efficient injection into the acceleration. So it may be that when the electrons are coming into the shock, they are not still thermalized enough to the ions such that they can actually behave as the same species, essentially.
I had a question about the electrons also, which is what mass ratio did you assume in the results that you showed, and have you obtained a scaling with mass ratio that would allow you to extrapolate to realistic mass ratio?
Okay. So the results that I've been showing is for a mass ratio of 16 for electrons. I have results for mass ratio of 100 as well. Here. So if you remember the previous plot, I don't have the two plots close enough, but if you remember the previous plot is essentially the same as this one. So the hierarchy and the acceleration efficiency for the protons are essentially the same for mass ratio of 16 and mass ratio of 100. For electrons, the conclusions are still the same. So electron acceleration is still depressed with respect to the proton acceleration. In terms of giving confident numbers, I have essentially trouble for one reason, which is it's hard to fit a Maxwellian plus power law in these cases. So it's difficult to disentangle what's actually the superthermal contribution in the electrons, where the superthermal contribution is so small. And the other thing is that when you increase the mass ratio, the comparison should be done at equal plasma times, or equal, depending on if the shock is magnetized or not, or equal like cyclotron times. So for a mass ratio of 100 with respect to mass ratio of 16, you need to go 2.5 times longer. So we have some cases in which we have done that, and we have, we haven't seen much difference in terms of results. But it's hard to do that for realistic mass ratio, just because you need to run your simulation for a very, very long times.
I have the microphone.
I'm still here until Friday. So,
and I have a question about the proton acceleration in magnetized shocks. I assume that your movie box was small compared to your overall computational box, and you seem to have quite strong waves already coming in at the right-hand side, even though the particles you showed were quite close to the shock. So I presume that you've got some particles going way upstream. I'd be interested to know how many have you got and how far they're going. And the other thing is that those waves which are coming in at the right-hand side seem to be quite strongly banded with a K-vector perpendicular to the shock, mm-hmm. which is quite different from what you normally expect to see with the Weibull instability.
Yes, yes.
So I'm wondering what this is telling you about the nature of the instability that's driving the waves.
You should tell me about that.
I asked the question.
So the... For the first question, the answer is yes. So actually, we are selecting a very small region, like I don't remember, it was like 500 skin depths of the box, and actually the box extends to 9,000. So it's way beyond that. The particles which are driving the waves are the particles which are farthest upstream, and the distance from the shock of these particles may vary essentially according to the inclination of the field. These particles are essentially moving along the magnetic field lines. So the more inclined the field, the less they move farther from the shock. In terms of what's the origin of these waves, it's absolutely true that they have nothing to do, I think, with Weibull. At this moment, judging from the polarization that I'm measuring in the downstream frame, they seem to be non-resonant with respect to the ions coming back upstream. So it may be that it's actually the Bell mechanism in relativistic shocks. I since I have time and to just to justify the title. So this is a movie with not very good time resolution of the behavior of the shock. Still, this is very small compared to the total length of the simulation. The purpose of this is to show that the shock is starting out. So the shock is starting out as a Weibull shock. So this filamentation is a Weibull filamentation. This is the very initial stage of the shock evolution. And then as you progress in time, what you see is that as there are more particles accumulating in the upstream, they are triggering this new non-resonant fluctuations, which are dominating at the later stages. So it's That's why I was sort of concerned about the long time evolution of the shock. So we are capturing this transition from viable to something else, which is the non-resonant instability, up to this point. If you wait for Hubble time, maybe something else is happening. But that's the.
Regarding the electron heating, you show in one figure the dependence of the electron injection efficiency as a function of magnetization. And there was one puzzling thing for basically for an unmagnetized shock, the Maxwellian, no, basically where you look at this sort of spectrum, the Maxwellian at the low momentum regime, the slope was actually different from the phase space factor.
Like this one, you mean the difference between the green? That's because it's 2D versus 3D. So for the unmagnetized shock, these simulations are 2D, but if you have a magnetic field, then effectively the velocity is filling both three dimensions. So in 3D, which is essentially like adding any field is enough to change your simulation to a 3D adiabatic index, you get a slope which is 2 with respect to, actually I guess 3 in this plot with respect to 2 in the unmagnetized case, because the simulation is effectively 2D.
In the test particle cases that you showed, the particle seemed to be always, even when it reached higher and higher energies, it seemed to stay all the time rather close to the shock upstream. So again, the question is, what are these particles really that are streaming so far away from the shock to generate these waves that come back?
So there are particles which are sent away from the shock at the initial stages of the shock evolution.
But why?
And these are the particles which are accelerated first. And there is no enough magnetic turbulence to scatter them back. So there are particles streaming away from the shock, even not leftovers from the initial setup. So these particles are streaming away, and there is essentially not enough magnetic turbulence to stop them from streaming away. I wouldn't say that they're streaming exactly at the speed of light projected to the magnetic field. They are streaming a little bit less than that. But they are not significantly slowed down. The drift of this particle is not significantly slowed down.
One, yes.